Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Author Margaret Atwood has an uncanny gift of foresight, taking on the big issues of the day. Her 1985 bestseller, The Handmaid's Tale, portrayed women as second-class citizens struggling to break free. In 2003, she published Oryx and Crake, about a global pandemic, just as SARS spread fear around the globe. Well, she's done it again, with a new meditation on debt, just as the credit crisis shakes the global economy. This hour on Point, Margaret Atwood on debt, payback, and the human condition. You can join the conversation. What does debt mean to you? Is it a natural part of our condition? And when did it become okay to be in debt? And what happens when we can't pay it back? And joining me now from Toronto is Margaret Atwood. She is the Booker Prize-winning author of more than 40 books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, including Cat's Eye, The Handmaid's Tale, and The Blind Assassin. Her new book is Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. The book is based on a literary lecture series this fall for CBC Radio. And Margaret Atwood, what a pleasure to have you, and welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you. I loved reading through this book, and I want to start right at the beginning. At the start of the first chapter called Ancient Balances, you tell the story of Canadian nature writer Ernest Thompson Seton, who gets presented with a bill on his 21st birthday. Can you tell us about that bill?
Well, the bill was presented by his father, and it was a bill for all of the expenses incurred in his upbringing, including the doctor's bill paid for delivering him. And Ernest was expected to pay it back, and he did pay it back.
Why did you like that story?
It's so bizarre.
It is bizarre.
And I've since come across a couple of other instances of people being given bills for their upbringings and delivery bills. And oddly enough, I found my mom's ledger from the 1930s when she first got married, and she kept it for years. And so I know how much they had to pay the doctor for me getting delivered, although they never presented me with the bill. It was $99, it was $107 in 1939. My brother was 99.
I guess the idea of this bill, you could almost call that original debt, as in the idea of original sin.
That's right. How much did you cost? These days, quite a lot.
But you do make this connection between debt and sin. You point out that debt in the Bible, in the original Aramaic language of the Lord's Prayer, that the words debt and sin are one and the same, right?
Well, debt and trespasses. We translate... In some instances we say debt, in other instances we say trespasses. And as a child, I always wondered why there were two. So as an adult, I have now found out it is that the Aramaic word can mean both. So a debt can be a financial debt, or it can be something bad you've done. And if it's the same word, then those two things get glued together. So is being in debt sinful? Is being a creditor sinful? Sometimes it is. If you're a really bad creditor and you sell people into slavery for their debts, as used to happen in Mesopotamia. So I investigate in the second chapter of this book the connection we have between debt and sin. And since publishing the book, people have said to me, well, is there any good debt? Isn't there good debt and bad debt? And they say, isn't college debt, you know, your student debt, isn't that good debt?
Mm-hmm. But what do you think about that? College debt, mortgages, all that debt that helps us build society and provide
those
jobs?
Those are good things as long as you can pay them back.
Right.
In fact, it's fine as long as you can pay it back. But as soon as you can't pay it back, it becomes bad debt no matter what you spent it on. Hmm. So the original use that you put the money to, once the bill comes due, it doesn't matter whether you've maxed out your credit card buying shoes or whether you've, you know, put your kid through college. If you can't pay it back, it's still bad debt as far as the creditors are concerned, and it's going to be bad for you, too, because they will pester you quite a bit.
Is that the only thing that makes debt bad, though, that you can't pay it back? I mean, aren't there bad debts that do get paid back?
Well, that then becomes a matter of moral judgment. You know, was it bad for you to borrow money and bet on the horses? You know, was that bad? I guess it depends whether the horses win or not. So there's intention and then there's outcome. And I'm looking mostly at outcome because the other things are a matter of very fine definitions about good and bad. The shiz for one person may be good because they make them feel better, and for another person they may be a reckless extravagance.
You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, this book is based on a lecture series which you're delivering this fall for the CBC, and you've been working on it for some time. I was amazed, you know, as I began reading this, to learn that you started work on this before the current economic crisis, because it seems so obviously significant right now. Did you have any idea how on topic you would prove to be?
I had no idea of how global and catastrophic the downturn would be. But I wasn't the only person who felt things have got too inflated. And when they get too inflated, there's going to be a pop and the balloon will deflate. It's a classic bubble scenario. And we've had them before in history. And even 3 years ago when I was planning out the series, there were tremors, you know, there were rumblings. And one of the things that made me really nervous was the fact that the United States government was plunging the country into debt through the war in Iraq, which went on way longer than they proposed and has cost a hideous amount of money.
Hmm. You, early in the book, and I just want to read this if it's okay, you offer one of the greatest summations of the subprime mortgage crisis in one sentence, maybe two sentences. You call it a pyramid scheme that most people don't grasp very well, but that boils down to the fact that some large financial institutions peddled mortgages to people who could not possibly pay the monthly rates and then put this snake oil debt into cardboard boxes with impressive labels on them and sold them to institutions and hedge funds that thought they were worth something. That is one sentence, and it just sums it up perfectly.
Yeah, I might revise it a little bit now in view of what we know, who purported to say they thought they were worth something, because maybe they didn't. Maybe they actually knew they weren't worth anything, and I guess that's going to be the subject of some investigations.
Well, if it wasn't sort of an obvious and apparent knowledge of the global financial structure crumbling before your eyes, why did you pick this topic? What was it that fascinated you about debt?
It is a fascinating topic because I think it's based on one of the fundamental things we do as human beings. And what we do as human beings, long before we invented money, for instance, we traded. And long before we traded objects, we traded favors. Favors or anti-favors like bites and kicks. Because we are social beings, and doing favors to one another, or conversely, having growling fits, that's part of the social glue, you know, that holds us together. Porcupines don't do this. They're very solitary. They only ever get together to mate, and that briefly and carefully. But we are really attuned to other people at all times. Just let me give you an example of trading. If you're in your car and you let somebody in ahead of you as a courtesy and they don't wave, nod, or honk, how do you feel?
Hmm. You feel, you should have done that.
Been, yeah, right. You've been done out of a thank you. Mm-hmm. You're owed a thank you. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you open the door for somebody and they just waltz through without saying thank you, you feel, okay, I gave them a door opening and they did not repay me with a thank you, and you feel done down.
You offered,
we do that all the time in so many ways every day.
You offered in the book a fascinating bit of research on primates, on chimpanzees. I wish you'd tell that story because I think that made a comical and beautiful point about this whole subject.
Yes, well, there's the monkey trading research and there's the chimpanzee research, and the monkey trading was so impressive to people interested in economics that it made it into Forbes magazine. And essentially they did study in which they taught the monkeys to trade using pebbles. And if they handed over a pebble, they got a cucumber slice, mm-hmm. which they then ate.
Sounds like
they were
a good
happily,
deal.
Yeah, a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were happily trading the pebbles for the cucumber slices. And then in full view of all the other monkeys, they gave one monkey a grape for the very same pebble. In other words, they violated the principle of fairness, and they violated the rate of exchange.
And what did that do to the other monkeys?
The other monkeys got very angry and started throwing food out of their cages, and 80% of them then refused to trade because they felt, of course, you cheated.
It's such a wonderful image of a group of angry monkeys upset over being gypped, having the rules of the trade violated.
They lost faith in the system, and that is what you have just seen in financial markets all over the world, because those systems are kept up by a belief, and that belief is that it's fair stuff that's going on, you know, that's above board, that people aren't cheating. And if you lose that faith, then everything just evaporates, because these trading schemes are human constructs. You know, they're there because we have faith in them. We credit them. That's why it's called credit. Mm. It has to do with belief.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with writer Margaret Atwood about her book, Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. And Margaret Atwood, before the break, I just want to just touch one more time on this image of these angry monkeys. You know, when there's this perception that the system is no longer fair, the system of debts and payback isn't fair, it breaks down. I mean, that sounds like a really important lesson for us.
I'm afraid it is. Will it fix things? Well, I think it will certainly fix things in the short run if people look at the rules and regulations governing these kinds of financial transactions and make them fairer and also more transparent. And that will help in the short run. What about the long run? Well, we do seem to have a habit of creating bubbles because we've created other ones throughout history. I think my favorite is the Holland tulip bulb bubble.
Mm. Tell us about that.
They were trading tulip bulbs, and they were quite rare and new on the market, and the price kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You would trade a bulb, you would buy it, you would sell it for more. And finally, at the top of the bubble, they were hugely expensive, and somebody must have woken up one morning and said, "It's just a bulb. You know, I can't eat it, I can't live in it, I can't wear it, and I'm not going to pay $1 million for it." And that's when bubbles collapse.
Interesting. I've often wondered that about gold. I mean, it's just a hunk of metal.
I know. Well, we have all agreed, it's a collective agreement, that it's worth something. Hmm. It's almost like the tooth fairy. As long as you say you believe in the tooth fairy, you put your tooth under the pillow and you get, I don't know what the rate of exchange is now, you get some money. But if you said one day, "I don't believe there is any tooth fairy," that might destroy the whole tooth fairy system. And similarly, if you say, "I don't believe the stock market is fair and above board and I'm not going to put money in it," down it goes.
Speaking of the tooth fairy, you actually draw a nice parallel early in the book between your early understanding of the tooth fairy and early understanding of banks. And you sort of conclude that section with, "Are banks real? Are they any more real than the tooth fairy?"
Yes. Well, grown-ups said they were. But they are similar in that if you stop believing in them, they do die. They go down, and you've seen that happening in former times. I think in the Great Depression of the early 30s, there were things called run on the bank, a run on the bank. You know that movie called A Wonderful Life?
Oh, yeah.
It starts out with a run on the bank. It's because people have lost faith in the bank's safety, and they want to take all their money out of it. So if you lose faith and belief, out comes your money, and you stick it in a sock under the bed if you've got any left.
At one point early in the book, you ask this question. You ask, why are we so open to offers of present time advantage in exchange for future, though onerous, repayment? What's the answer to that?
I think it's part of our nature in that when the only money was food, as it were, if you didn't take the low-hanging fruit and eat it, if you said, oh, well, I'm going to hold off on this for 3 weeks, you'd be dead. Mm. So we are programmed to, if it's there right in front of you, it's very hard not to grab hold of it. And that's what happened with credit cards in the early 70s when they became widely deployed. Companies used to send them out in the mail to people, no questions asked. And you'd get this letter, and it looked as if you had $1,000. It felt like yours. So you went out and spent it, and then it turned out that it was a loan, and you had to pay interest on it. But if it's right there in front of you, right, it's hard to resist.
Yeah. And you trace this change in our culture when society moved from this idea of debt as something to avoid, as something to embrace, to that sort of run on the credit, to that embrace of credit cards.
Yes. Well, I think in the 20s, there was a lot of free spending. It was another bubble era when things just seemed to be going up and up and up, and that gave us the Great Gatsby and champagne parties and that wild 20s period. And then everything crashed. It was called a crash. Down it went. And people became very frugal. And they remained frugal during the war years because you had to conserve. And if you had parents like that, you probably got some of those ways. I'm still a string saver, for instance. But then everything changed. The 50s were boom times, and then along came the credit card. In former times, however, the only debt you would think of getting into that was at all big was your mortgage. Mm. And that was supposed to be backed up with something. That's why we call it real estate. It was supposed to be realer, more real. And we've just seen that notion kind of shot to hell.
Mm. What do we?
Not always as real as you think it is.
Speaking of mortgage, there's so much in this book that I learned and loved reading about. Speaking of mortgage, explain the etymology of the word mortgage, which I think tells us something about what we engage in.
Yes. Well, it's a funny sounding word. It's two French roots, and one of them means dead. And that's the M-O-R-T part. And then there's the G-A-G-E. And that's the same gauge as you have an engagement ring. Hmm. And it's a pledge. And it's also, you know, romance novels about with duels in them. Here's my gauge. It's your pledge that you're going to turn up the next morning for pistols at dawn. So you're engaging to do something. And when you have a mortgage, you're engaging to pay it off. And when you do pay it off, the pledge becomes dead because the scales are even, both sides are even, it's paid off. So that's the idea, and it ought to make you think about those engagement rings and what exactly it is that you're engaging to do.
Yeah, it's an interesting word, and when you think about it that way, you know, it might have spared a lot of people the trouble they got into. I mean, instead, it seems like mortgages for a while were sort of given out as permission to buy more house than you can afford or that you should afford.
I think that they were urged upon people as that, and people were told that the value of their house would always go up so that they would always have positive equity in it. But it isn't true that values of houses always go up. Hmm. Over the long term, they probably do, but there are a lot of bumps along the way.
Let's go to Joanna, who's calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Hi, Joanna.
Oh, hi, Anthony.
What's on your mind?
I actually have a thought, and I think Margaret's subject is really, really important. I consider the system, the economic system that we live in today, and the control by all the credit card companies and the financial companies as some kind of forced indentured servitude. If you go back a couple of hundred years before the Industrial Revolution, we were all working in workhouses or whatever, and the only place we would get to spend our money is the store that was set up by the employers of our workhouse. So the money was going around in such a small circle that we weren't getting any benefit. And I think the system that we exist in today is some kind of an advanced form of that, whereby we're forced to, I mean, we're not forced to use credit cards, but I can understand that people, if they've got mouths to feed and they've got no money and they've got a credit card standing there, then they're going to feed their kids first and think what to do with the bill later. But I think that we've been forced into this situation where it's really difficult to get out of, and effectively we're indentured servants to the financial industry and the credit card companies. And I'll take your response offline. I was just wanting to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure, Joanna. Thanks. Margaret Atwood, what do you think of Joanna's idea that the debt we willingly sign up for is a kind of indentured servitude that we commit ourselves
well,
to?
Well, it depends how much of it you sign up for. And I think credit cards are terrific. They're really handy. They're in all of our lives. And they're great as long as you pay them off in the same month, because then you don't have to pay any interest. So you get into trouble when you don't do that, and then the interest builds up. But I'd like to add to that thought, the place in our lives where we really are indentured servants is through the income tax system. And you can calculate how many days you're actually working for the government and how many days you're working for it yourself. And this, too, is a situation of very long standing. It wasn't always called income tax. There have been taxes on all kinds of things, including windows and facial hair on men and bachelors. But taxes have been there for a very long time. And I would say that the indentured servant idea is probably more rightfully attached to them. And there's quite a bit about taxes in my book.
I'd be more comfortable, maybe it's just because, as we know, we can't avoid death and taxes, thinking about taxes more progressively and, you know, this is something I willingly pay to live in a progressive society and have public schools and have services and have my garbage picked up. And
That's absolutely true if you get those things.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't.
Sometimes you get a lot of other stuff that you don't want. Right.
You don't want some of the other stuff, and you do want some things that you don't get, and therefore that's why taxes are always on everybody's mind when they're doing the voting. What am I getting for my tax dollar? And it's not exactly that you willingly pay it. In fact, if you don't pay it, you're probably going to go to jail.
Let's take another call. Carrie is calling from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I'm listening to the program, and I just had to call to make a comment. I'm a small business owner. We have had to use debt to start our business and to stay in business, not necessarily to pay payroll taxes or taxes, but it has been definitely something that we have undertaken at times, and we would not have survived without the ability to do that, and there is a good place for going into debt. We've had to use credit cards when our business could not pay our salary. And, you know, it's taken several years to, you know, get that down. So, you know, although I do agree that we don't want to be indentured servants to credit cards or be a slave to that, it does serve a useful purpose in a small business economy, which our economy is built on the survival of the small business.
Well, Carrie, thanks for that call. Margaret Atwood, Carrie's talking, I think, about good debt, productive debt.
Yes, I entirely agree with that. And the reason we call currency currency is that it has to flow. And because money just sitting in a drawer isn't actually doing anything. So when the system is working properly, it flows through in the way that she has described. And in fact, one of the reasons that Ebenezer Scrooge and Charles Dickens's Christmas Carol, who features quite a lot in my book, one reason he's bad at the beginning is that he accumulates all of this money and does nothing with it. He just sits on it. He doesn't put it back into the system. And one of the problems that the world is having right now is the credit crunch. In other words, the money that should be available for lending to, for instance, small businesses, somehow isn't there. And this is going to put a lot of people in a bad position because the currency is not flowing through in this way.
Carrie, thanks for the call. Let's go to Elaine, who's calling from South Hero, Vermont. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think what I'm talking about, what I'm thinking about as I listen to you is more the long-term picture. I'm thinking of endless debt. I'm thinking of debt as a result, not a cause. Like, long-term debt has to do with character and value systems and a sense of entitlement that I see in people. We've gone into a system, and it's not new. I mean, when I look back in history, we're repeating lots of things that have been done before. But we seem to measure ourselves through stuff, what we have, the size of house. We measure other people through stuff frequently. I'm certainly not talking about everybody by any means. And
Elaine, are you saying to get that stuff by which we measure ourselves?
I'm going to go in debt, and it's a very short-sighted thing, but they see the debt is not as important as the stuff they go in to buy, the house that's too big, the jewelry that's too expensive, etc. Not somebody who's in a small business and needs working capital, and debt comes and goes, and it's a fluid kind of thing. But I'm more concerned about human character that I'm seeing right now, and I was horrified by the debt we went into in this war. And I don't want to get into politics. I'm kind of relieved that we're not talking about politics right now.
Yeah, we'll stay clear of that a little bit. Well, Margaret Atwood, let's get Margaret Atwood's response to this idea of debt is what we willingly take on to accumulate our stuff in this increasingly materialistic society.
Well, I think her point was that it is increasingly materialistic and that maybe stuff is not a good way to measure ourselves. There have been cultures in which your character was measured not by how much stuff you got, but by how much stuff you gave away. So you were a big person in the community if you were a big giver. And warlords of the past, for instance, wouldn't have had any followers if they hadn't redistributed the stuff in a way that was perceived as fair to all of the people who had helped them get the stuff in the first place. So there is another side to the circulation of stuff, which is giving things away and getting credit for that. And maybe we do not give enough credit to generosity in our society. Maybe we give too much credit to accumulation.
I mean, to bring this back to the current situation, this global economic crisis, I mean, that's what it's all about, though, isn't it? I mean, this was about the accumulation of stuff and people getting in over their heads and not being able to pay it back.
And that was, and they were very much encouraged to do that. You probably have seen some of those ads that say, because you're worth it, or you owe it to yourself. And people of a certain generation very much were given the idea that it was that they were entitled to this stuff. And so however they got it, that was great because they owed it to themselves.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. Margaret Atwood is our guest. She's written more than 40 books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Her new book is Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Margaret Atwood, you spend some time, quite a bit of time in this book, talking about debt as a literary subject. And of course, it comes up all the time through in literature. Shakespeare, Hamlet, neither a borrower or lender be. The Merchant of Venice, of course, is all about debt and having that pound of flesh. It dominates lots of literature. Why is it such fertile literary ground?
Well, first of all, I think because it's a plot driver. You know, it puts the characters into a situation in which they have to do something. And novels and plays are both time-driven. That is, there has to be an event, and another event. So it sets up a situation of conflict that they somehow have to deal with. But in the 19th century, it becomes particularly prevalent because it was a century with a lot of social mobility. People were going up, and other people were plummeting down. and it was a century in which the Industrial Revolution had kicked in, but nobody understood boom and bust cycles. They hadn't figured that out yet. So suddenly you might find yourself, you'd invested in something you thought was safe, and suddenly it was worth nothing. And there you were in debt. There were no social safety nets, so you might find the bailiffs arriving at your house. You'd be cast out into the street, or you might even end up in debtor's prison. A very silly idea, because you were put into debtor's prison because you couldn't pay, and you had to stay there until you could pay.
Progressive punishment wasn't really thought about in such a progressive way then. I loved what you wrote about the 19th century novel. You said, when I was young and simple, I thought the 19th century novel was driven by love. But now, in my more complicated years, I see that it's also driven by money, which indeed holds a more central place in it than love does, no matter how much the virtues of love may be waved idealistically aloft. And you talk about Madame Bovary, for example.
For example, yes. She... What really brought her to grief was that she overspent.
Not her adultery.
And no, she could have gotten away with that for a long time because nobody ever suspected her. Mm-hmm. So she could have carried on with that quite happily, but she got over her head into debt, and then her creditor was going to turn up and reveal all. And her fate would not have been kind under those circumstances. She would have been out in the street without a penny. Oh, so that's when she commits a rather unpleasant suicide.
So are you thinking, as a writer, one of the great writers of fiction, is your next book going to involve this theme of debt?
I don't think so. But I think somewhere on the planet there's a 10, 11, or 12-year-old about the age Charles Dickens was when his father got put into debtor's prison and he had to go work in a blacking factory. And felt his life was ruined. There's a kid out there, his family has been very badly affected by this financial situation, and 20 years from now, you'll see the wonderful book about that.
Hmm. Let's take some more calls. Scott is calling from Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Scott.
Well, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. And have I seen you or heard you on Bill Moyers?
Yes, you have.
I have, okay. Well, the only thing I want to say is, it's more of a comment, but my definition of credit is buying things that you don't, spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like. But what I wanted, by the way, you may use that sometimes you're talking.
Oh, thank you.
But I would like, the thing is, if you really told people what was going on, they wouldn't put you on the air. Because if we were out of debt, we wouldn't have any money. Money is debt. I've got Federal Reserve notes in my pocket, and note means debt. And, you know, Albert Einstein, someone asked him what the most powerful force in the universe was. He said compound interest.
Yeah, it is pretty powerful.
Exactly what it is. Bernard Baruch said money is debt. If we didn't have any debt, we wouldn't have any money. The whole thing is based on a false premise. And you were talking about people having confidence in gold or whatever. This whole system we got is a confidence game. There are a few con men up there that have got us all in debt. But, of course, you can't say that or they wouldn't put you on the air. Your book wouldn't get published.
Oh, she can say it if she wants on this air.
I pretty much did say somewhat similar things. But it all works okay as long as people aren't totally lying, cheating, and stealing, but that's a big as if, because it is very tempting if the rules are relaxed. If things are deregulating, it is a big temptation to put your hand in the cookie jar.
Mm. Scott, thanks for the call. Let's go to Sage, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Sage.
Hello. Thank you, Anthony. Hello,
sure.
Margaret.
Hello.
I'd like to provide sort of the flip side of that last call. I'm a carpenter working in Boston, and I've had a chunk of debt on student loans and credit cards for about 10 years now, which is sort of affecting my life to a large degree and my psychology as well. And I didn't put anything on it like a new car. I've never had a new car. I can't even remember the last time I had new shoes or anything. I mean, I'm a very frugal person, and I've still barely been able to make a dent in that debt. But I kind of incurred that getting a degree in sociology, which did not turn into money. It didn't turn into a job. The world was not exactly as I had expected when I was younger. But now I'm working as a carpenter and still trying to pay off that debt. And I just don't want everybody to think that debt is always a result of buying new cars or new computers, new TVs or whatever.
So no, it absolutely isn't. Yeah.
So equating the word debt with sin, for example, makes you uneasy, I would imagine.
Exactly. I wanted to comment on that and say that, yeah, that's very interesting, the roots of the word. But to me, the original sin could also be seen as the huge inequality that people start with in this world. And I didn't come from a place with money, so to get a degree that I thought would give me a salary, I had to incur a lot of debt, and that didn't pan out as I expected. And I've been working hard. I've been paying off the debt. I believe in the system, but I just want to recognize that we all start from different places, and, you know, not everybody's buying the flashy sneakers and cars and everything.
Yeah, all right, exactly.
So, yeah, Sage, no, I appreciate the call.
Yeah, it's exactly true. But, again, people are, when they go into student debt, what they're really doing is gambling on their future. And you have to do that to see if it's going to work out okay, but sometimes it doesn't, and then people are stuck with this. I've been told some pretty horrific stories of particularly medical students being offered these huge loans, and the lenders are gambling on their becoming a very well-paid doctor, but meanwhile, when they graduate, they have this ginormous debt that they have to pay off.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Stuart is calling from Belmont, Mass. Hi, Stuart.
Hi there. I'm curious as to Ms. Adwood's thoughts on the following, and that is that taking a different point of view, that debt is really just another form of capital, and taking on debt implies another side to the transaction, the creditor, or
exactly.
In some cases an investor who
yes.
may look on debt favorably as a good use of resource. So I've heard a lot of discussion that demonizes debt to some degree. I'd like to hear the other side of that story, if you would, please.
Well, I think we heard a bit of that other side of the story from the small businesswoman who said that this is how she's built up her business. And it's entirely true. And I did say that currency is only currency when it flows, and that this is one of the ways in which it flows. And what we're seeing right now is a credit crunch, which means a lot of people will not have the working capital that they need. There is quite a lot in my book about the fact that debtors and creditors are twins. You can't have one without the other. And there's also a premise that it's the whole system is based on the balance metaphor, in which you ultimately have to balance the scales. So it's not that debtors are bad and creditors are good. Either one can claim the moral high ground depending on the circumstances. The moment at which both of them vanish is the moment at which the debt is paid off.
Hmm. Stuart, thanks. I mean, we talked about the idea of good debt. By the same token, it sounds like you're saying there's good creditors and bad creditors. I mean,
I think that's entirely true.
Yeah, yeah. In the latter category,
I put people who
sort of foist credit cards on people who have no business having credit cards, but sort of knowing that
possibly. Yeah, there's a bit about loan sharks in the book. I'm a great fan of Elmore Leonard, and his book Get Shorty has a perfect little description of how loan sharks operate. And that's in the really shadowy part of the shadow side of wealth, because the interest rates are very high there. And if you don't pay off, something very nasty might happen to your kneecaps.
Let's go to Jeff, who's calling from Pageland, South Carolina. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
I just have one question to ask Ms. Atwood, and I don't use credit myself because I don't believe in it. If you can't pay cash, then you don't need it. But do you think it is fair that the American taxpayers and non-credit users should have to bail out the credit system?
There's going to be endless discussion about this for years and years to come. And the thing that there's always great disagreement about is when people have a choice of evils. You know, that one, they don't have a choice of something that's really good versus something that's really bad. They've got two things that are bad, and they have to choose between them. So I think the choice facing people was, do we let the whole system go down in flames, or do we put enough money in it to keep it afloat? And that is a choice of evils, and they took the second one, but a lot of people got pretty mad about it.
Jeff, thanks for the question. Margaret Atwood, I have a question for you. You're talking to us from Toronto, Canada, and I'm interested in the answer to this question. This financial crisis that we're in the midst of course, it has tentacles that reach all across the globe, up into Canada, I assume, as well. But how does the attitude up there differ from the attitude down here? I mean, that is, this is a crisis that sort of mushroomed out of the United States' financial system. Are the Canadians looking at this and sort of saying, well, that's just so American? you guys are known for being a little more modest and frugal.
We're known for being frugal. One of our cultural commentators, Northrop Frye, said, Americans like to make money, Canadians like to count it. So we do have a lot of accountants up here, and our banks are more regulated. But anybody who believes that things that happen in the United States do not have an effect here is quite wrong, and we're already seeing that effect, not in the banks plummeting into oblivion, but when Americans stop spending, that affects us, of course, because a lot of our trade goes south of the border. Hmm. So everybody on the planet has been affected by this.
I think we have time for one more call. Let's go to Susan, who's calling from Barrington, New Hampshire. Hi, Susan.
Oh, hi there. I've done a lot of business in Europe, and I have a number of friends, and there seems to be a totally different attitude about debt in Europe. It's not a positive thing to have. A mortgage is about the main thing that people feel is worthwhile going into debt for. And years ago, I was at a conference in which a Swiss economist noted that, or predicted that, Americans' love of debt would ultimately lead to a tremendous financial crisis. And this was probably in 1999. And he said another interesting thing. He said, affluence breeds arrogance. But the problem with Americans are that you have false affluence in your credit environment, but you have real arrogance. And I'd like Ms. Atwood to comment on that.
What do you think, Margaret Atwood?
Well, I think that just changed a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think there's false affluence anymore, and we'll wait to see what happens to the arrogance. But I don't think it's completely true that Europeans were not involved in this, because they were.
Yeah, and I've also read, I don't have the statistics in front of me, Susan, but I have read that consumer debt, while probably as high as it can be in the United States, the Europeans are doing a pretty good job, at least in some European countries, in catching up with our kind of numbers. So, but as I said, I don't have those figures in front of me, but I'm a little skeptical that they are somehow free of this. But thanks for the call, Margaret Atwood. Let me sort of end this with kind of final question: will we ever learn? Will the current entanglement with debt teach us a better way, or is it your view that it has always been thus and will always remain so?
I think necessity is a great teacher. And also, when there's a meltdown or a catastrophe of some kind, people always go, oh, how bad we were. We're going to reform our ways. And that does happen for a while. So I think it really depends on what's out there to be grabbed. Do you know that Batman movie in which the Joker throws all the coins and jewelry all over the floor and everybody scrambles around to get some? If other people seem to be on the take or behaving in a certain way, it really encourages that kind of behavior in everybody. So I think you are going to see a return to frugality, and you can even call it stinginess and saving, for a while.
Mm.
But will that last? We will see.
For a while.
Maybe.
Yeah, until.
Maybe forced upon us.
Right, or until sort of the next cycle of history when we can't resist that low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, but the real money is food. Mm-hmm. And what people should really be worried about at this point is the planet's ability to produce food. Because when food becomes scarce, money becomes worthless.
Well, Margaret Atwood, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about this. It's been great.
And thank you.
I'm indebted to you. Can I say that?
Absolutely. And all you need to pay me with is a thank you, which you've already paid.
Okay. Margaret Atwood, esteemed novelist and poet, is the author of the new book, Payback, Debt, and the Shadow Side of Wealth. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.